Thank you for those words of welcome, Nora. And thank you, Andrea, and others for extending the invitation and getting me back into Fredericton again. Fredericton sometimes seems like a second home to me because of the Joshua Bernard case. That case went on, even though the case originated in the Miramichi country. It was heard here in Fredericton for weeks and weeks on end at the trial level, and the second appeal level in front of the New Brunswick Court of Appeal took a week, again back up here in Fredericton. So I seem to get to know a lot of the places and a lot of the sites. And indeed, I remember quite fondly going over to the St. Mary's community and doing a presentation over there during the course of the Joshua Bernard trial and receiving a eagle feather and memento for it. And indeed, I also can't help but remember that it was during the course of the time here in Fredericton, while the Joshua Bernard case was going on, that the Donald Marshall decision was handed down by the Supreme Court. And so I can well remember the trying to get a plane back to Halifax on a Friday afternoon and having the media people chasing me out there with cameras trying to get a statement about a decision, and all I knew about the decision was, well, we had won, but I had no idea what the court had to say about the treaties or the treaty rights. So thank you for getting me back here to speak to you tonight. I was asked before we started what to do about questions, and I got some prepared remarks here, of course. But I'm very, very happy if anything that I say stirs something in your mind and you want to ask a question as we're going along, please do that. And also, I'm counting on you to be asking some questions about the things that are on your mind. Otherwise, it may be a very short evening. The topic, as Nora pointed out, is negotiating Aboriginal and treaty rights. And perhaps you could tell from the introduction that, for me, that's a new kind of position or a new kind of role. But what I wanted to talk about tonight is basically to carry the message that at this point in time, at least for the Mi'kmaq of Nova Scotia, the time has come to embark upon that process of trying to negotiate with the two crowns these very complex issues of Aboriginal and treaty rights. Wanted to start by reading to you some excerpts from a letter that was written by the Minister of Indian Affairs for Canada to the President of the Union of Nova Scotia Indians in 1978. And by way of background, you should appreciate that, and I'm sure a lot of you who are students in the Aboriginal field know this by way of background, but up until 1973, the concept of Aboriginal title was not well regarded within the legal system in Canada. And it wasn't until Frank Calder and the Nishka people from British Columbia took a case to the Supreme Court of Canada that was eventually decided in 1973 that the Canadian government took Aboriginal title at all seriously in the country. And as a result of the Calder case in 1973, the federal government adopted I know an infamous term, but nevertheless adopted the comprehensive claims policy to negotiate claims of Aboriginal title where they had not been extinguished in the country. And the Mi'kmaq of Nova Scotia at this time said, well, we have Aboriginal title in Nova Scotia. We have these comprehensive claims in Nova Scotia. And I'm sure that in New Brunswick, the Union of New Brunswick Indians and the other organizations were going through the same kind of thought process. But the Union of Nova Scotia Indians submitted a claim saying, we have a claim to be negotiated. And they submitted that claim in 1976. And what I wanted to do was just read two paragraphs of the letter that eventually came out from the Minister of Indian Affairs at that time, Hugh Faulkner, in 1978 in response to the union's claim. It's addressed to the late Alexander Denny, Grand Captain of the Mi'kmaq Grand Council, who at that time was president of the Union of Nova Scotia Indians. Dear Mr. Denny, our analysis of your claim has been completed, and the legal opinion which we have received from the Department of Justice has been reviewed. As you know, the government's 1973 policy on comprehensive claims provides for the negotiation of those claims where Indian title has not been extinguished by treaty or superseded by law. And those of you who have been around for a few years know that there's an infamous paraphrasing to be associated with this idea of superseded by law. We have concluded, after careful study of your claim, that Indian title in Nova Scotia has effectively been superseded by law, thus placing your claim outside the terms of this policy. In Nova Scotia, the actions of successive pre-Confederation and post-Confederation governments in opening up the lands of the province to settlement, in granting such lands by letters patent, in granting various rights to third parties, and in setting apart other lands as Indian reserves, have had the effect of superseding Indian title in all areas other than reserve lands. In other words, you don't have an Aboriginal title claim in Nova Scotia. It was the same reaction to the claims in New Brunswick. There's nothing here to negotiate. In June of 2002, now we're skipping forward to 2002, the Mi'kmaq in Nova Scotia signed this document with Canada and with the province of Nova Scotia, which, among other things, said that the parties, meaning Canada, Nova Scotia, and the Mi'kmaq in Nova Scotia, shall enter into good faith negotiations directed to achieving a framework agreement on Aboriginal and treaty rights negotiations. The parties agree that the mandate of the Treaty and Aboriginal Rights Negotiation Table shall include issues of definition, recognition, and implementation of the constitutionally protected rights of the Mi'kmaq of Nova Scotia. In other words, Canada in 2002 committed to the Mi'kmaq to negotiate in good faith the definition, recognition, and most importantly, the implementation in Nova Scotia of the constitutionally protected rights of the Mi'kmaq of Nova Scotia. And of course, you will understand that by the constitutional rights, what we're talking about are Aboriginal rights, Aboriginal title, and treaty rights. The whole ball of wax of things that are protected in the Canadian constitutional structure in Section 35 to do with the special rights, including rights of self-government, of Aboriginal people in Nova Scotia. And that's the process that we've been embarked upon. Now, what happened between 1978 and the Minister of Indian Affairs saying, you have no Aboriginal title, it's been superseded by law, and the commitment made by Canada in 2002 to negotiate that very issue with the Mi'kmaq in Nova Scotia? What happened? Well, a couple of things happened. One thing that happened is the Jimmy Simon case in the Supreme Court of Canada in 1985, which was the first relatively modern case dealing with treaties. And that was a case that we took out of Nova Scotia. We lost at the lower level courts in Nova Scotia, but eventually the Supreme Court of Canada said, yes, that treaty signed by Jean-Baptiste Cope in 1752 is still valid today and still provides a defense to a hunting charge in an off-reserve situation to Jimmy Simon from Indian Brook. Another thing that happened, it actually happened before the Simon case, but it is a completely separate issue, is that the Constitution was changed in 1982. It was changed in 1982 to add a constitutional level of protection for Aboriginal title and Aboriginal rights and treaty rights. And but for that change in 1982, there wouldn't be any Donald Marshall case, and there wouldn't be any Joshua Bernard case, for that matter. So that was an important thing. Then the Supreme Court of Canada in 1990 in the Sparrow case told us for the first time what the new provision in the Constitution meant when they put into Section 35 in 1982 the existing Aboriginal and treaty rights of the Aboriginal peoples of Canada are hereby recognized and affirmed. What did that mean? They told us in Sparrow. Then we had the Delgamuukw case in 1997, again out of British Columbia. But we had the Supreme Court of Canada then telling us how you approach issues of Aboriginal title, how you prove questions of Aboriginal title. And that case was obviously very important to British Columbia, but that case really opened up the door for New Brunswick and Nova Scotia and Prince Edward Island and the Gas Bay areas, that is the traditional territories of the Mi'kmaq and the Maliseet and the Passamaquoddy peoples. Because the very tests that they talk about there were applicable here. The rights were based on long use and occupancy, never extinguished or taken away by treaty or otherwise. And then what really drove Canada, I would say, to the table was the Marshall decision in 1999. After the Marshall case, something had to be done. Something had to be done by the federal government in order to implement that decision. We don't need to get into the history of that unless you want to. My short synopsis of what happened is the federal government decided to offer very large carrots to induce First Nations to ignore their rights for the time being and fish in accordance with commercial licenses, and to put the rights-based kind of fishery in a holding pattern pending subsequent negotiations. And so when, in 2002, they committed to the Nova Scotia Mi'kmaq to do that, they saw that as the next logical step in seeking to implement the Marshall decision, is to have negotiations in which the objective would be to define and implement a treaty-based right to fish. So that's the process that I think we're engaged in now. Of course, since 2002, we've had the Joshua Bernard case coming out of the New Brunswick Court of Appeal, a very, very successful case, I think, from the standpoint of the Aboriginal parties involved. We had the Nova Scotia Court of Appeal in a parallel case involving logging activities in Nova Scotia, in which there's a great deal of similarities between the two courts of appeal decision, but also some differences. Joshua got acquitted, subject to whatever happens in the Supreme Court of Canada, but he got acquitted in Nova Scotia. The court sent it back for a new trial, which hasn't yet taken place because it's been appealed to the Supreme Court. And then, I guess, the last thing to point out in the litigation front, other than the fact that those two cases are pending decision in the Supreme Court, is that in New Brunswick there have been two successful cases dealing with the right to harvest forest resources for personal use or for domestic consumption, not for trade or sale. That was the Joshua Bernard case, but the other two cases, a Maliseet case and a Mi'kmaq case, dealing with getting access to Crown lands for forestry purposes. That background, which we could go into in more detail if you want to, I just wanted to use as a sort of leaping stone or a prelude to say, well, what drove Canada to the table and drove the Nova Scotia government to the table, and maybe we'll be driving the New Brunswick government to the table, I'm not sure, is the fact that in litigation, their feet were held to the fire and they got burnt. They lost. The rights of Mi'kmaq, the rights of Maliseet, the rights of Passamaquoddy, rights of everyone who were beneficiaries of the treaties have been upheld. And that background is really important. But it sort of provokes the next question is, well, if that litigation has been successful, and let's pray and hope that the Bernard and the Nova Scotia logging cases are successful in the Supreme Court. But it begs the question, if the courts are upholding your rights, why bother to negotiate? Why don't you just keep going to court? What's wrong with keep going to court? And I guess the way that that I would approach it, part of what message I wanted to convey to you tonight is the courts can only do so much. There's an awful lot that courts can't do. There's a lot that can be done at the negotiating table if you have three parties of goodwill who are seeking to resolve the issues. For example, courts are very fact-specific and very issue-specific, so that you can't deal broadly with issues like access to the fisheries, across all of the fisheries for all of the communities, across all of the areas where different species are harvested. You can't deal with access and management of crown lands in a comprehensive way through a case that deals with one particular cutting site in the Little Savogal area of the Northwest Miramichi for Joshua Bernard. Another thing that you can't do through litigation very well is to get the court to give you a kind of remedy that addresses those bigger issues. Courts are very, very reluctant to tell governments what they must do. They're good at telling governments if they've done something they shouldn't have done, that they've overstepped their boundaries. But if you want a kind of remedy that is positive or directory, that tells them you must do this, you must give access to this particular piece of land over here, or you must give access to this species or this volume of timber, they're not very good at doing that. If you want land as part of your resolution, which I think it is sort of a obvious statement that everyone expects that negotiations lead to more land for the Aboriginal parties, not necessarily as reserve land, but land held in some other way. For example, when the Labrador Inuit just completed their claim in Labrador, part of that was to deal with lands that would be conveyed by the Crown and held in the same kind of land title system that the non-Aboriginal people use, that is a title, what they call fee simple, which is the highest estate that the Crown can grant from its own territory or its own land. So that land becomes fee simple land. Well, you could never get a court very easily to specify what quantity of land should be allocated or should be put into fee simple ownership for Aboriginal people in New Brunswick or in Nova Scotia. That's not the kind of thing that courts do or are very good at. The other thing particularly important for negotiations or why negotiations are needed is that when that Sparrow case was decided back in 1990, the court set up a give-and-take process. And I guess I've never called it that before, but that's probably a very good way to look at it. It's a give-and-take process in that the court says, well, we are giving by recognizing that Aboriginal people have a right to, say in the Donald Marshall case, harvest fisheries resources for their livelihood. But having given that in their decision, then they took it back by saying, but the Crown can justify infringing that right or limiting access to those resources if they meet a kind of justification test. And so anytime you get involved in a particular piece of litigation, and I've been involved in Indian Brook's lobster fishing disputes with DFO in St. Mary's Bay in Nova Scotia, and part of what happens in there is that the Crown comes forward with all kinds of information about lobster biology and about the conservation of the resource, and is sort of talking about what access or further access to the resource would do by way of damaging the fisheries resource. And what it comes down to is a kind of concept that is actually mentioned in the second Marshall decision of equitable sharing of the resource. And so, you know, what could easily have happened in that case is that the court would say, yes, they have the right to fish for lobster, but we don't know how much they have the right to fish for. Yes, there's a massive non-Aboriginal lobster fishery in the same area, but what would be an equitable share for the Mi'kmaq to harvest out of the same fishery? How do you determine that? Well, if you're sitting at the negotiating table and you're negotiating across a variety of fisheries and a variety of issues, then you might be able to achieve something that you could agree upon as being a reasonable approximation of what's equitable for that particular fishery or for all of these issues put together. So I think that's the kind of issue that negotiations are really designed to achieve. And the last thing along those scores that I wanted to say about why negotiations are important is that negotiation is much more likely to result in a long-term solution that people are happy with. People aren't happy when some external body like a court or, as has happened in the past, like DFO or the Brunswick Natural Resources or somebody tells you what it is you're going to have or you're going to get. When you don't have a role in shaping the form of the final resolution, if you can work towards something that you're happy to agree to, you'll probably live by it. And the same thing with the crowns. And you'll be much happier in the long term as a result. That's why in collective bargaining situations, governments are very reluctant to step in between an employer and a union and impose a contract, because they know that the parties are in a long-term relationship, just as the Mi'kmaq and the Maliseet people are in a long-term relationship with the Crowns. And if you can fashion an agreeable relationship for the future, it'll make for better longer-term relations than to have one party or the other simply impose their idea of what's fair or their idea of what they can live with. Negotiations should result in an agreement which the parties are happy to live with and move into the future with. I want to tell you a few words about the state of negotiations in Nova Scotia. As Nora said, we have a negotiation team set up in which I'm designated as the lead negotiator, but by all means that doesn't mean that I'm a dictator or that I run the show. We have another person who's been long affiliated with the Confederacy of Mainland Mi'kmaq, Eric Shiley, and he and I are really co-negotiators. We have appointed two people through the Assembly of Nova Scotia Mi'kmaq Chiefs, who meet every month to talk about our negotiation issues. They've appointed two people to be senior Mi'kmaq advisors to the negotiation table with particular responsibilities for communicating with the 13 communities. And Dr. Viola Robinson from the Acadia First Nation and Joby Marshall, the Executive Director of the Union of Nova Scotia Indians and from Eskasoni, were appointed to those two positions. And then we have other staff people now that have been appointed under that process through competitions, through open competitions conducted by the Assembly of Nova Scotia Mi'kmaq Chiefs. We have a director of research, we have a communications coordinator, we have another researcher, and we're just in the mode of trying to organize for hiring for a couple of other positions to help with all of the background that's necessary for these negotiations. At the negotiating table, we're doing what that umbrella agreement I just read to you pointed out. That is, we're negotiating in good faith towards a document called a framework agreement. Now, what a framework agreement is it sets out the process for the real negotiations. Everything is a kind of prelude. The umbrella agreement was the first step that we took. The umbrella agreement, from our standpoint, was extremely important. If you guys in New Brunswick are getting into this kind of mode, I think you should think seriously about having a similar agreement, because what that did is, A, committed the two crowns to the negotiations, but secondly, it committed them to negotiate these issues on a without prejudice basis. And that's something that we've always placed a great deal of stock on in Nova Scotia. Whenever the government wants to meet, we're always trying to be clear, is this consultation? Is this like on the record and could be used to our prejudice if you wanted to use it? Is that why you're approaching us, or are you approaching us off the record and without prejudice? And the umbrella agreement set up a process where what we're doing towards the framework agreement is all without prejudice, meaning that anybody can go in to the table and say whatever's on their mind, and they know that it'll never show up in a court somewhere at some point in the future. Nobody will say, oh, well, you were willing to do this or you were willing to do that before. Why aren't you willing to do it now? Or you said this before and you're saying something different now, if it should turn out to be that way. So that's been very important in the umbrella agreement. So the negotiations up to the framework agreement are on that basis. The framework agreement will set out the parameters of what is going to be negotiated by way of definition, recognition, implementation of Aboriginal and treaty rights, what that process will look like, and there are other without prejudice protections and clauses that would be built into that kind of agreement. If we're successful in doing that, and I should say in Nova Scotia, we're at the point now where particularly the two senior advisors are going out to the 13 First Nation chief and councils and meeting with them on a one-by-one basis or an individual basis to talk about the framework agreement, to see what their reaction is and what level of support is, and to seek their permission to meet with their community members, and so that we can go into the communities, meet with the general community at a community meeting, meet with influential families, meet with elders, meet with youth groups, meet with Mi'kmaq organizations, tribal councils, people who are employed in the First Nations in areas of responsibility that are connected to the negotiations, so that all of these people will be informed and will be able to influence, hopefully, what the framework agreement ultimately looks like. So we're trying to do this in a way that ensures that it has bottom-up support, and it isn't something that I'm waltzing in with or the chiefs are waltzing in with and saying this is the way it's going to be. Instead, we're trying to say, here are the things that we're trying to do. What do you think? Do you approve of it? Do you have concerns? What are those concerns? Do you think we've adequately addressed those concerns? And we're trying to build that consensus. And if we have that consensus, then we'll achieve a framework agreement. And that's when the real business of negotiating the implementation of rights will get on. There are several other steps that would be involved if we get the framework agreement. One of the most important, I think, is to start getting interim agreements, or to put into place interim measures that will make a difference in the lives of the people in the community, so that people will actually be able to access, whether it's forest resources or access wildlife or access fisheries or access land for that matter, or start protecting land so that at the end of this process, maybe a decade away, the land won't be already given away any more than it already has, or encumbered by other kinds of interests that the government creates. So we're trying to think about how to make sure that there can be a meaningful agreement years down the road. There's a whole bunch of areas in which you could do that kind of activity. We'll be guided by the Assembly of Nova Scotia Mi'kmaq Chiefs as to what areas they want to give priority to. The next step in the process would be to deal with particular subject matters in a substantive way, and eventually to achieve both, we might call it chapters or subject matter agreements, and then a larger agreement in principle that would cover everything to do with the three big subjects: land, resources, and government, or self-government. And if that is, that will be the hardest step, I think. If that is successful, then there would be a final agreement. It's only the final agreement that would have some legal effect, legal binding effect. And if there is a final agreement, it would be accompanied by what I would call the sixth step, which is an implementation plan of how you actually take that final agreement and work out the details of transferring land or having powers of government that are operative. So that's the process we're involved in. We're still at this framework agreement stage. We've been meeting with Tom Molloy and the provincial representative, Jamie Campbell, and their teams of people since November of 2003. So it has been going on for some time. There's a whole bunch of questions that people ask from time to time. I've got a bunch of questions here that I'm going to sort of pose to myself if nobody wants to be bold enough to ask a question at this point. For example, one of the questions on my list is, well, how are things going at the negotiating table? And the answer I would give is probably better than you might have expected. Going pretty well at the negotiating table. The things that we've identified as being our concerns seem to have been adequately addressed as far as we as negotiators are concerned. Now, of course, as I said, it's all got to come back to the communities, and the community's got to say, well, we're happy too. You didn't sell everything out in this agreement, that, you know, it's something that's reasonable and that we think you should proceed with, or identify other concerns that they think should be addressed. But you know, sometimes you go into these processes and you can go into them without very much optimism, and you think it's all, you know, pie in the sky and nothing useful is going to come out of it, particularly if you, I think this is fair to say about our approach, is we knew what kinds of things were achieved in other framework agreements in other parts of the country, and that wasn't good enough for us. And so we wanted things that weren't in those other agreements, and so far we're quite happy with the way that has turned out.
So I have two questions. One, how did you guys structure? I know there's, you know, we have the same problem in New Brunswick now, where we're dealing with two organizations, UADI and Maui, and I know the structure in Nova Scotia, you have Union of Mainland Mi'kmaqs and Confederacy.
Well, you have the Union of Nova Scotia Indians, which was originally all 13. Then the Confederacy of Mainland Mi'kmaq, a number of years ago, a decade or so, decided to split off. But they don't really, their geography doesn't coincide with all of the mainland, because Indian Brook and Acadia didn't go with Confederacy. But the point is still the same. There are two political organizations that represent different communities.
Very similar.
Yeah. Well, I can say this about it, that the organizations get along very well. It was not that way, because when the Confederacy split off, it was in reaction to their perception that the Union was dominated by the Cape Breton bands and that they had no control and no influence, so they created their own organization. But over the course of time, it turned out there were more things that united them than divided them. And I think I would personally attribute a lot of it to the chiefs deciding to work through a different body that they created themselves. As I've mentioned several times tonight, the Assembly of Nova Scotia Mi'kmaq Chiefs. That is an unincorporated deliberative body that the chiefs decided to create. It has no constitution, it has no legal mandate or no legal existence or force. But the chiefs said, we've got to talk about things together, and we can't go off as two separate organizations and discuss them as board of directors in two organizations. And the kinds of things that we really need to discuss together are the rights issues and the larger policy issues, so we can sort of stay out of band specific situations or politics and let each community do their own thing. But where we decide to work together, let's meet, let's talk about it, let's get over our differences, let's act for the common good. And that has begun to work pretty well in Nova Scotia.
Well, I'm not going to apply too much to the conversation to back that up. But the other question I have is one Nova Scotia, what they're doing in Nova Scotia. Do you see any positive? I see some positive, but any negative impacts on what we're doing in New Brunswick, or is it pretty much right with the train already that we just got to ride it, so we're predetermined? And the other one is where you're housed as far as chief negotiator, co-negotiators, and your internal staff, is that under the Assembly of Nova Scotia Chiefs, or is that under one of the other organizations?
Well, when we started down this process, we weren't sure. I mean, one of the starting principles that the chiefs in Nova Scotia had is we want the ability to walk away from these negotiations at any point in time. We don't want to get locked in financially or otherwise. So we'll accept money to finance our participation. We will not accept any loan funding anywhere at any time.
Under the Assembly of First Nation Chiefs, that's where you're accepting the funding?
Okay, well, I'm leading up to that point. I mean, you keep me on track here, and that's good. But the point I wanted to make is there is funding. They obtained the funding through the Federal Negotiation Preparative Initiative, which is a grant-based program. But the point that I wanted to emphasize is right from the get-go, the chief said, we want the ability to walk away. We don't want to be locked into any kind of financial commitment. And we will never accept loan funding to participate in this. Because, you know, what happens in the comprehensive claims process is you get to the point where you're negotiating the comprehensive claim and the federal government says, oh, you want $2 million to negotiate? We'll loan you $2 million this year. You want $2 million next year? And a decade away, you're owed, you know, $100 million or something. And they say, okay, well, your claim's worth $120 million, so we'll give this back the $100 million you already spent, and here's $20 million, and that's all you have out of it. And the chief said, no, we're never going to be in that position. We're never going to accept any loan funding. We want to negotiate this on the basis that our participation is covered as it goes along, and we never go into debt over it. And so they don't make any long-term financial commitments to the staff. There's not a bureaucracy in that sense. And to answer your question specifically, when they started this and they said, we don't know how long it's going to run, we don't know if we can get a framework agreement, we're not prepared to sign a framework agreement like they did in other parts of the country, but maybe we can do a better job. And if we do, then we're going to be in a longer-term road. And so they used the Confederacy of Mainland Mi'kmaq to be the basis for funneling the money and paying the staff until the point in time when they saw that this is likely to work as a long-term process. And then they decided they would incorporate their own society under the nonprofit society in Nova Scotia to handle the money and to be responsible to the assembly for the negotiations. They didn't want to incorporate the assembly. And so just recently, like last week, the incorporation papers came through, and the name is slightly different than what Nora said for the name of the organization or the society. The name of the organization is the Kwilmuk Maklusuagan, excuse my pronunciation, Negotiation Office. Negotiation Office. And our interpretation of the Mi'kmaq words is searching for a consensus or searching for an agreement. So that new entity, as of tomorrow, will be financially responsible for the operation of the negotiation office. And we're actually meeting with our negotiation, you know, with the Canada and Nova Scotia's negotiation teams on Monday and Tuesday. And that's one of the things that we'll be talking to them about, is confirming that the money for the next fiscal year is in place and will flow to the new organization, but everything that we've been told is yes, that works for them, and that's the way it'll be handled. And just to put the cap on that sort of financial issue, so when I've said, well, we have the staff, and you know, we have the researchers and the director of research and all that kind of stuff, they're on a contract basis where their contract is tied to that funding that comes from Canada and Nova Scotia, so that they know that if at any point in time there is no funding, they have no job. So it's not like we're building up a long-term financial commitment and the people, you know, are expressly being told, you may have no job the next fiscal year because, I mean, technically you may have no job tomorrow because we haven't got a letter in our hand that says there's money.
Yes, Mr. Smith, you mentioned the word willingness.
Yes.
What do you suggest or recommend when there ain't no willingness, like say, what's possibly going on here in the province? You might have two out of three parties that are willing to come to the table, and one of the three parties ain't willing to come to the table. How do you dance around that one?
Well, I don't have to dance around it, as you know, because I'm not in that box, and I would certainly have to defer to the political leadership in New Brunswick to decide what is in their best interest about it. I guess I have two sort of off the top of my head comments about it. One would be what has, I think, brought Nova Scotia to the table, because I don't think that historically they've been the most liberal in their attitudes towards the Mi'kmaq people in that province, is the litigation. I mean, they know that there are legal issues that they have to deal with, and the courts keep telling them that they have to negotiate. And indeed, as I'm sure most people are aware, the Supreme Court of Canada recently came out with the Taku River and Haida decisions that said the governments have a duty to consult, i.e. negotiate, even when there isn't a proven or established claim. That is, you don't have to go to court first and establish the position in order to have the right to compel consultation. And so, you know, I think that that has given a very powerful legal tool anytime you think that your rights are being impacted or affected by a government decision, to say, you know, you breached your duty to consult with us, and maybe it's going to be necessary to pull the crowns to courts on a few occasions to have the courts tell them that. So that's the first thought that that you know I have about it. And I guess the second thought would be, well, if one party, and as I understand it, it is Canada, is willing to talk, maybe there are things that can be usefully accomplished with Canada that don't require the participation of New Brunswick. And for example, one of the things that leaps into my mind is I think that one of the greatest obstacles to advancement, you know, both sort of social and economic advancement in the Aboriginal communities, is the limited powers of governance that comes out of the Indian Act. So, you know, in the Nova Scotia negotiations, I think it's pretty clear that we're talking about governance models that are way above and beyond anything that the Indian Act or any First Nations Governments Act or whatever, anything like that, is talking about. So governance should be something that is entirely within the federal mandate. And, you know, I think it should be entirely possible to deal with Canada in the absence of New Brunswick over the question of the governance structures for Aboriginal peoples in the province. So that's sort of a quick off-the-top remark as well. Maybe there's somebody you can do business with, and maybe you've got to hold the feet to the fire of the other one.
I have a question. It's a separate question. On the revenue board now, this week, vote on the policy regarding private ownership on reserve land. I was wondering if you heard anything about it, if you have any comments about the risk and the benefits of it. I didn't get much just the article, and it wasn't too specific, but it's a great question.
Yeah,
anything?
Be simple.
It spoke about mortgages, spoke about renovation, mortgage your house for renovation, and for higher education, and that was the thing that raised questions.
Yeah. I don't really know enough about it to comment too much. I mean, I know that there are problems with the way that the system is set up now in terms of, you know, being able to get certificates of possession and getting security that the banks are happy with and getting things that are properly transferable from generation to generation. So I just don't know enough to jump into the fray.
The Land Management Act, which a lot of First Nations have signed into, which is just part of the Indian Act, section, whatever. And all it does is it says that Native people are become actual title holders of their land, saying they get the say as to what's going on. But what it also does is it allows people who are part of that community who don't even, you know, reside in and around, like someone from maybe Florida, would have a say in how the people that are living in that territory should govern their land. Which, you know, remains to be seen what's going to happen, but, you know, you've got a lot of things to happen, I guess.
Well, privatization seems to defeat the purpose of reserve land, owned by the nation.
Well, they're supposed to be communal lands that are inalienable to anybody else, that it's held. Well, I haven't heard anybody talking about it in Nova Scotia, so I'm a little vague.
I was just wondering, is the Grand Council involved in any of these negotiations?
I'm glad you mentioned the Grand Council. The Grand Council is not directly involved in it all, but the Assembly of Mi'kmaq Chiefs, Nova Scotia Mi'kmaq Chiefs, has added to the numbers beyond the 13 chiefs certain ex officio members who are invited and attend and receive honorariums to attend the meetings, and that includes the Grand Chief. It included the Grand Captain, late Grand Captain, when he was alive, and would presumably include his replacement when that happens. And we also have, traditionally in Nova Scotia, the chiefs have had a technical advisory body, and the Grand Captain had always participated as a member of that body as well. And I think at the last assembly meeting, the chiefs resolved that when there is an agreement or a document that they're going to sign, they want the Grand Chief to sign as well to indicate the support of the Grand Council. Grand Chief did sign the umbrella agreement back in 2002, but I think he signed it as a witness rather than as a distinct party. Yes, the Grand Chief signed as a witness to all of the other chiefs, the other 13. But that is an issue as well. I just finished the comment off. When the Mi'kmaq decide what their governance structure might be, then they'll have to decide how they're going to resolve the issue of the Grand Council, whether the Grand Council will have a political deliberative kind of role, or whether the Grand Council will, you know, play a different kind of role within the governmental system.
For example, like what claim do I have, like, or Nova Scotia develops this, where do we stand in authority?
Yes, well, that's another excellent question, Chief. That's always been on the minds of everyone in Nova Scotia. I know that some people say, well, why are the Nova Scotia chiefs kind of going off by themselves, and why aren't they doing something on a basis of the traditional nation? And I can't answer that except to say that the chiefs are making it clear that in these discussions to do with Nova Scotia, they are only dealing with the rights of the Nova Scotia Mi'kmaq in Nova Scotia. And they are not dealing with their rights, that is Nova Scotia Mi'kmaq rights, that might be, say, in New Brunswick. And they're certainly not dealing with the rights that Mi'kmaq in New Brunswick might have in Nova Scotia. That is outside the boundaries of discussion. And similarly, one of the things that has been talked about is that one of the things that they're interested in achieving is a document which would ensure that if at some point in the future the Mi'kmaq decided that they wanted to be governed in along the lines of the traditional structure across Gaspé and New Brunswick and PEI and maybe south coast of Newfoundland or whatever, that whatever agreement they made now for Nova Scotia would not preclude the Mi'kmaq all getting together across the five provinces and developing a different kind of regime. So I think the fairest way that I would put it from the Nova Scotia standpoint is they want to do what they can now without impacting adversely on anybody that's not a Nova Scotia Mi'kmaq or on the idea that maybe everybody will be able to get together in the future.
I don't see that as such a significant problem, but more like if you look at the treaties for sign, like a lot of them said, you know, Penobscot or Wabanaki people, which was just an assumption of like a few people that they were signing it with, to just say that the natives rather than specify everyone, they were just classified all of one people, rather than the different walks of life, which are of the native people, like the different tribes and bands. But, you know, I see a lot of what the Mi'kmaq are doing. And, you know, like, at least we're stepping up. A lot of things are actually getting done, and we're all benefiting from it. But it's just some people might view that as a stereotype, saying, you know, just for Mi'kmaq. But it implies for all native people.
Yes, and I should also point out that we've been approached by at least two other Mi'kmaq organizations, that is the Maui Omi from the Listigouche area. I forget what it's exactly called now, but involves the Listigouche and the Gaspé communities. They have their own sort of preliminary discussions with Tom Malloy, et cetera, and they would like to liaise with us to know what we're doing and vice versa. And the same thing with the Confederacy of PEI, Mi'kmaq, and in both cases, the Assembly of Nova Scotia Chiefs has authorized us to, you know, have full discussions with those other parties. So, I mean, if UNBI or anybody in New Brunswick wanted to say the same kind of thing or make the same kind of request, I imagine that it would be treated in the same way. So it's not like they want to keep secrets amongst the Aboriginal parties. Yes. Yes, I heard about that.
Yeah, there was a couple of interpretations that I heard. I was wondering if you could have some clarification on that, because one interpretation I heard was that these people, the community members that have been charged under the Crown Lands and Forts Act, were
I can't clarify it. It's for the courts to eventually clarify. But my interpretation always had been, this would be my understanding, is that when the stay was put in, it meant that no one could harvest forest resources and say that they were relying upon their treaty right or their Aboriginal title right to do so. Now, that didn't stop people from harvesting for their domestic use under an Aboriginal rights as opposed to a treaty right or an Aboriginal title. It's just that the treaties that were involved in the Donald Marshall case were involved in the Joshua Bernard case, or the Aboriginal title that was involved in the Joshua Bernard case could not be relied upon by way of defenses.
Can they push that position where they can't use the treaty right as a defense? Like, what defense would they have under the Crown Lands and Forests?
Well, I think that the thrust of the decision was that they shouldn't have been harvesting until the courts had clarified whether they had the right to do so or not.
Well, I think that, you know, people in the community, that information was not forwarded by any leadership to them that that was the case. They believed that they were harvesting under their Aboriginal rights.
Which they may have been able to do under the concept of Aboriginal rights. Like, I'm making the distinction here between the rights that were involved in the Joshua Bernard case and other rights that Aboriginal people would have. For example, if you're harvesting the forest resources for your own personal or domestic use, that you could do under an Aboriginal right.
Well, which is what the people that have been out there have been charged. I mean, there was an allegation of a commercial nature, but I mean, those allegations, what exactly what they were, allegations.
Yeah. Well, no doubt they have lawyers involved in the case, and those would be the people to turn to for guidance. But my sort of gut reaction is, well, if they were not selling and if they were doing it for personal use, that the Joshua Bernard stay should not have impacted on their defense at all.
Now we have fishermen that are working for the band, and they go out fishing and say they were out of the zone area for some reason, like whatever, they sort of went off the zone area. They're being charged. My question is, shouldn't the DFO have come to the chief and council and consult with them, since the agreement is between them, to address that issue instead of taking these people to court right away?
Well, that would be a very desirable policy to be followed, and it would be conducive to a proper long-term relationship for that kind of thing to happen. But there's no legal requirement that I am aware of some kind of first warning. You know, when you're speeding down the road and the cop pulls you over and decides not to give you a ticket and to give you a warning, well, that's a discretionary decision that they have. And the DFO officers could have exercised the same discretion to come to the chief and council or to warn the individual fisherman. I know, for example, when Donald Marshall was charged, he was warned several times by DFO officers, you know, Junior, you shouldn't be here. We're going to have to charge you. And he kept going back to his chief and saying, Chief, should I continue to fish or what should I do? And chief said, you keep fishing. And eventually DFO then charged. But he had warnings and he knew that this could have been what happened. There's a lot of unfortunate things in the way the government does business. I think you had your hand up for a few times.
I'm fishing.
Oh, you're fishing.
This is just for your comment. I've always been troubled by the ideology that if these governments were lawful in what they were doing, they wouldn't be able to meet those kinds of justifications. What would cause another nation to justify, I think, just a legal thing, you know, and say that they have a superior right to take somebody else's property? It seems like this extinguishment ideology is superseded by law and so forth. Obviously, it's self-serving, but it seems to be the undertow of a lot of what we're doing right now in terms of negotiation. I think the fact that treaties exist implies that there's already procedure. If those treaties are active, then it is under the treaties that we're negotiating, and not under, you know, what courts are suggesting. I've always been troubled by that whole framework that we're talking about.
Let me just make the distinction between extinguishment and superseded by law, which are very much the same kind of concepts, and the concept of justification, as the Supreme Court has talked about it, starting in the Sparrow cases and Donald Marshall case, for example. I think it's very, very clear that since 1982, when they changed the constitutional structure, no crown, province, or Canada has the power to extinguish unilaterally rights that then exist. And the concept of superseded by law was really thrown out in the Sparrow case, because that was the essence of the federal government's position about why the Fisheries Act continued to apply. Is they said, well, we've been regulating the fishery and limiting Aboriginal access ever since, you know, 100 years, years after Confederation. We've been doing this for 100 years. And so our Fisheries Act is valid and operative, and everybody has to comply with it. And that was, in essence, saying, well, your rights were superseded by the Fisheries Act, superseded by Fisheries Act as a law. And the court said, no, that's just a regulation, and the regulations can be changed, and that doesn't affect whether the right continues to exist. But for a given measure or a given activity that the federal government decides to engage in, they could justify limiting your access to your rights if they followed the proper steps. And one of the proper steps that has not really been talked about very much, because the courts really haven't come to grips with this whole justification idea, is the idea of minimal infringement. So to my mind, there is no justification for the federal government to take away in any kind of permanent way access to your rights, because that would represent something other than minimal infringement. I think the best case that they could make out, which is where I always suspected they were coming from on these fishing agreements and that whole process of making those fishing agreements, is to say, well, we just can't all of a sudden turn the Atlantic fishery on its head and ensure that every Aboriginal person in Atlantic Canada can make a moderate livelihood out of it, because we would have thousands of people displaced, da-da-da-da. But we can have a transition period. That we can justify as having a transition period, and the first step in the transition is to get some kind of access and make some kind of agreements or offer to provide some form of access, knowing that it's not going to be adequate over the long haul, but it's a starting point. And then we can go to court and we can sell the idea of some access. We did the best we can and we're still trying to do better. So that's the idea of minimal infringement, but sort of reversing it. It's like maximum, we're trying to get it down to minimum, but it's the idea of a transition period and being able to sell a transition period.
I'm not sure I can really articulate this, but am I hearing you saying that if it wasn't for the sake of 1982 constitutional section 35, then we wouldn't have had these cases? Because what I'm saying here is that kind of troubled with the way this whole thing is being played out as it is now, as it has been played out historically. And I'm kind of waiting for this divine intervention that helps to take these matters outside the domestic arena, because it seems that there's a clear pattern of self-serving at the disadvantage of First Nation.
Well, just on that final, your final note, and but I'll come back and address some of those other issues, but on the final note, just before I came over here tonight, they were talking to the lawyer that was involved in the Quebec language case that the Supreme Court decided earlier today, and he was sort of throwing his hands up in the air and saying, I don't know what the heck they meant. I don't know what this is all about. But the other thing that he said was, now we have to go to the International Court of Human Rights under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, because Francophone parents in Quebec are being denied the right to send their children to English language schools. Apparently 70-80% of the Francophone parents want to send their kids to English schools, and the Quebec government won't let them. The Supreme Court said it was okay now for them to be so restricted, and the answer that this lawyer was saying is, now we have to go to the international realm. And, I mean, you've hit the nail on the head in terms of, if you want to do something more, then get out and get out from underneath the jurisprudence of the Supreme Court. That's the only avenue that's available. Now, I don't think that it's a simple thing to do. That's a whole different story. But I wanted to come back to your initial statement about, well, but for the 1982 amendment, we wouldn't have had these cases. And that is indeed right, because there had been a whole series of cases before then in which Aboriginal people who held treaty rights, for example, some of the Western groups, migratory birds the same way, they went to court and said, we have a treaty, uphold our treaty, we shouldn't be convicted of charges under this piece of legislation. And the courts, prior to 1982, consistently said, no, statute takes priority over your treaty rights, and so you're convicted. Doesn't matter what the treaty says, we have to go by the statute. And that's because one of the attributes of Canadian law is that treaties, even international law treaties, you know, treaties made with the United States or whatever, are not binding in domestic law in Canada unless they've been implemented through a piece of legislation, which is different than the law in the United States, just as an example. And that's why, for example, the Jay Treaty that everybody likes to talk about, the Jay Treaty is respected in the United States without any implementing legislation. But in Canada, the Canadian government doesn't respect it because it was never implemented into Canadian law. And you have to have a piece of legislation that implements it. Yeah, even if the treaty is enforced, that's right. The treaty is not what they call self-executing. It doesn't have any operative standing in Canadian law. You have to actually implement it through a piece of implementing legislation. The other point to be made about the Supreme Court's treatment of the treaties, et cetera, is, you know, I think you can rightly feel some sense of outrage that the Supreme Court set up the justification test they did, because they drew that out of thin air. Section 35 is the first section outside of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. There's 34 sections that constitute the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and the first section gives the government the right to justify overriding all the other rights and freedoms. If you can do it in a free and democratic society that is sort of demonstrably justified. And what the Supreme Court decided to do in Sparrow is take the equivalent of Section 1, which is only in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, completely disengage it out of the Charter of Freedoms and drop it into Section 35 and say, okay, well, yes, we're going to uphold the rights, but we're going to give the trump card to the crowns to justify infringing those rights whenever they can meet a test that they said was fairly stringent. But, you know, the way that the Crowns interpret this so-called tough or hard justification test is they go in and say, well, you know, we're managing a complex resource, and you've got to let us manage it. Well, yeah. Don't even have ownership of it. We have a management responsibility. But, I mean, that's the essence of what they say. And the Supreme Court has always used the word conservation can justify overriding the rights. But when DFO comes into court, they say, oh, well, we have a management regime, and the whole management regime would be upset if we did something different than the way we manage the commercial fishery. So, you know, it's our management needs that really override your rights. And the Supreme Court has, in charter cases, said administrative convenience. That doesn't justify overriding charter rights. And so DFO's management convenience should never override Aboriginal rights. But that's the case that they make when you face them in court.